we realized that heifers only have, they can go two directions. They can either go into the feeding system or they can stay at home in the breeding herd. The steer is going, the bull calf that's turned into a steer is definitely going to harvest. And so we look at that value. And then to even back it up just a little bit more, just looking at the percentage of heifers on feed as a percent of the total cattle on feed. And what we know is that number sitting around 40% of the cattle on feed right now are heifers. That's ridiculous. I mean, there's no retention there. There's no retention there. And so what we're going to have is something closer to like 34%. Essentially, one third of the cattle on feed will be heifers, and then we'll know we're actually retaining heifers to put back in the breeding herd.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost digestive health, performance, and profitability with Digesterone Prime, a feed additive that enhances digestion and immune function in beef calves. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/prime. DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit ProEarthAnimalHealth.com today. Control the cortisol surge and control your drug costs on your inbound cattle. Make the 21-day SHOT Show a thing of the past with QFA 2000. Are you tired of rolling the dice on calf scours? Get on the Pharmatan Clean Cow Clean Calf program ahead of calving. Go to Pharmatan.com for more details. Trusted ingredients, proven performance. Rangin Livestock Nutrition. We partner with a purpose. Boehringer Ingelheim puts cattle first with innovative health solutions, vaccines, and care for your herd. Visit BIAnimalHealth.com/cattle.
Welcome back to the Beef Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Dr. AJ Tarpoff, and we are dedicated to bringing you the latest insight and discussions from the cattle industry. So sit back, get ready to expand your knowledge with today's episode, and today is going to be fun. We're going to dive into some cattle markets. We've got a lot of questions, a lot of ground to cover, but I want to introduce our guest today, Dr. Andrew Griffith. He's a professor and extension livestock economist with the University of Tennessee. A little bit of background about, looks like started off in Tennessee and came back to Tennessee, right?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
You bet. So did his undergraduate degree at University of Tennessee, master's degree at Tennessee Tech, came out west for a PhD at Oklahoma State University, and then finally went back. So is now at University of Tennessee. He's originally is a Tennessee native, grew up on a corn and soybean, stocker cattle and cow-calf operation, so very diversified. His program focuses on risk management, working with cattle producers to look at both inputs and outputs for market stocker and feeder cattle. So with that, I guess, Dr. Griffith, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. We'll get into kind of our key topic later, but tell us a little bit more about yourself, what you do, who you work with, kind of your role within the University of Tennessee system.
Yeah, so I've been with the University of Tennessee since 2012, so we're right at 14 years now. And primary, 100% extension appointment, but I also do participate in research and research ideas and grant writing, you know, because that's what the research is, what drives things. And the research that we focus on is based off of what I bring back from an extension standpoint. So what those producers need, that's what we focus on. That's what we try to go after and do research about. So I've literally, for the most part, for those that are familiar with extension, you know, we have extension in Tennessee in every county. There's an agent in every county. And so I work directly with them and to serve their producers based off the questions that they have as it relates to livestock markets. Primarily, I was hired as a livestock markets person, but I also do a bunch of production work as well as forage production work. Just mainly because those are things that are very integral to whether it be cattle, small ruminants, equine, dairy, whatever it is, though all those things kind of filter in together. And it's really imperative to also know the grain markets as they're going to play into the markets of all these livestock at the same time. So just working with producers individually or as groups and those county agents is who I primarily serve, but I also enjoy the opportunities of getting out of the state of Tennessee and working with producers in other states.
No, that's great. And I hope everybody picked up on that key component of the land grant mission, getting the questions and the communication from producers of what matters most, and taking that back to the university to find answers, and then ultimately get it back out to everybody. I mean, that's what we all do in Extension, and I really appreciate you bringing that up.
Is stress affecting your bottom line? Even routine handling, inclement weather, weaning, and dietary changes can significantly lower the rumen pH, causing cortisol levels to spike. Cortisol not only compromises the immune system, but also suppresses normal appetite and feed consumption. The solution? Cattle Active. Increase production and reduce the impacts of stress on your cattle for cents a day. Cattle Active restores the balance naturally. Want to learn more how a feeding program including Cattle Active can improve both profits and herd health? Visit us today at proearthanimalhealth.com. Be proactive with Cattle Active.
So I guess with that, let's dive in today. I mean, let's start looking at some of our cattle markets, our the economic outlooks. It's a interesting time to be in the cattle business. Is that the best way to describe it?
You bet it is. I mean, these prices have gone just wildly high, and it's amazing to think about a few years ago, maybe selling a freshly weaned calf, 550-pound calf for $750, and now we're talking about $2,500. Somebody brought to my attention a group of weaned and vaccinated 580 something pound calves that brought well over $5 on Saturday at a sale in Tennessee. I think it was 540 or something is what they brought. And so when you think about that, there is just a lot of money involved in this business relative to what it was 4 or 5 years ago. And that's not all due to inflation. That's supply and demand at work right there.
Well, it is. It's supply and demand. Yes, cost of production has gone up, throughout time. We're well aware of that. But these are really, really extremes that we're working with right now. What are the main drivers shaping this cattle market right now? What has driven things to that extreme? What are we playing with right now?
So, I mean, it really does go back to just basic supply and demand. And so a lot of the talk has to do with supply side, and I'm not saying that's the most important side of it. I really think the demand side is more of the driver than the supply side, but let's briefly touch on the supply side. You know, we're at the lowest beef cattle inventory in 75 years or so. So when we think about that, that is a factor. Now, what a lot of people don't factor into that, and I've written some popular press articles on this, but they don't think about the fact that cows are a lot bigger today than they were 75 years ago. So 75 years ago put you back to 1951 or so, and we're producing a lot more beef with a lot fewer cattle today. I even think about just when I started in 2012. The average weight of a finished steer was probably 12 to 1,250 pounds. Well, now we finish them at 1,500 to 1,550 pounds. So we've added 300 pounds of live weight. And some of that is due to genetics. Some of that is due to feeding cattle longer. And what we do know is we're producing a lot more fat because of how long we feed these cattle. But if the supply side, from the supply side, that is an important factor of what's going into or what's playing into higher prices. But in reality, demand is what has been the bigger driver of prices. And so I'll take us all the way back to coronavirus just briefly. I mean, I realize that was 6 years ago. It's hard to think it was 6 years ago, but 2020, probably about this time, we find out there's this virus from Wuhan, China or something. And what it did was it shut down. It kept people from traveling. It kept people out of restaurants. And, you couldn't even go to church. You could go to the liquor store all you wanted, but you couldn't go to church. That's just the truth. But what happened there was the consumer had to start purchasing beef from the grocery store. Now, we remember there was also a short time when you couldn't get meat from the grocery store because people were just hammering those grocery stores. And well, if you know how a packer works, they've got lines set up for different outlets. Well, they've got a line set up for the grocery outlet. They've got lines set up for food service and restaurants, and they don't have the same cuts on them. So anyway, once they got those things fixed and we started having plenty of meat, and well, people found out they could buy beef items. They could prepare them the way they liked them, and they were actually good at it. And they have continued to do that. So their discretionary dollars, despite the fact that now they can go back out to the restaurants, despite the fact they can go back, travel wherever they want to, what they found out is they still like to eat beef. And, you know, we have a culture that is experience-based, and so they want to have these experiences eating. I don't care what you have. Just keep eating it, right? As a beef guy, just keep eating it. I don't care how you eat it. Just keep eating it. But the general consumer, despite a bunch of chatter on news media or whoever about how high beef prices are, even our president, you know, has made several statements about we need to lower beef prices, and he's made some moves. And recently, the move of, you know, opening up Argentina to 100,000 metric tons, not that big of a deal to me. Doesn't matter to me because it's really not that much beef. But despite people talking about how high beef prices are, consumers continue to buy it. So that is a clear indication and a clear sign that the consumer wants beef and they're willing to pay for it. And we hadn't found a price at which they say we're going to stop paying for it. Now, people say, well, we're going to knock some people out of the market. Well, that's what higher prices are supposed to do. Higher prices ration products. So we're trying to ration the consumption of this product. People keep buying it. So guess what happened to prices? Beef prices increase, cattle prices increase. And if you're in the industry, you think that's a great thing.
And this is at the same time. I mean, fill me out here. But our other proteins, when we look at the poultry, we look at, you know, swine operations, their production is not, their supply is not dropped off like the cattle industry. So we are competing in the meat marketplace and still out competing it with a higher valued product at a moderate volume compared to what they're producing.
Oh yeah, by far. So, you know, pork production and beef production generally run about the same on an annual basis. Now, pork production is higher than beef production right now. Whereas poultry, and that's probably, let's say 20, let's just round numbers, 24 to 26 billion pounds a year. All right. And poultry production is closer to like 48, 49 billion pounds a year. And so they've been able to ratchet up prices a little bit because of beef prices. But yet the consumer, just like you said, the consumer still desires beef over those alternative proteins. Now, the poultry industry has been hit a little bit on the turkey side due to avian influenza situations. On the chicken side, it's mainly been layer eggs, so really hadn't hurt broiler production or meat production per se, unless it's canned meat from, you know, getting rid of layers. So, no, you're exactly right.
Beef is performing with our consumer.
It is. Well, you know, and here's the, think about this. This is why it's performing. Think about how those two industries are structured versus how the beef industry is structured. So both of those industries really went into a vertical integration type system. And that vertical integration, they worry, their main concern is feed efficiency. Feed efficiency, feed efficiency, feed efficiency. So converting feed into pounds of meat. Well, in doing that, I mean, chicken, I don't know that chicken's changed a whole lot because of that, because chicken is whatever you put on it. That's what chicken is. I don't mean that negative towards the chicken people. That's fine. I mean,
no.
But that's what it is. And now see, you go to the pork industry, and people actually used to like pork. But now the problem is a loin from a hog is no good. It has no fat on it. It's so lean. They've bred them to be so lean, and they're worried about efficiency. Even if you look at bacon. Bacon doesn't even have as much fat on it as it used to have. And what is bacon supposed to be? Fat. It's the pork belly. And so the beef industry has focused on quality of meat as opposed to the quantity relative to how much we feed. So feed efficiency, we've been working more on quality. Now, we still do work on feed efficiency, correct? I mean, you know, when we look at EPDs and this, that, and the other. We want animals that perform efficiently. But that has not been the focus. The focus has been on increasing the quality grade based off of how we grade beef in this country, because that's what the consumer in this country wants.
No, I couldn't agree more. But back to supply and demand. You know, we've got a fewer animals in the marketplace that are getting, and what are the indicators you are looking at? Are we going to expand the cow herd? What signals should cow-calf producers and people in the industry keeping an eye out for? Obviously, more animals coming into the system to try to maximize and get the most out of this market. People are thinking about it. But what market signals should people keep an eye out for regarding herd expansion? What are you looking at?
So, I mean, you know, the data that we look at to kind of see if we're to indicate any type of expansion, number one, we're going to look at heifer slaughter. That's an important number. Heifer slaughter relative to steer slaughter, because what we know is if 50% of the animals end up being male, 50% of them end up being female in general. I mean, I realize you can use sex semen, but it's not like we have a bunch of commercial producers doing that. So we expect 50-50. Well, when you come into that and we realize that heifers they can go two directions. They can either go into the feeding system or they can stay at home in the breeding herd. The steer is going, the bull calf that's turned into a steer is definitely going to harvest. And so we look at that value. And then to even back it up just a little bit more, just looking at the percentage of heifers on feed as a percent of the total cattle on feed. And what we know is that number sitting around 40% of the cattle on feed right now are heifers. That's ridiculous. I mean, there's no retention there. There's no retention there. And so what we're going to have is something closer to like 34%. Essentially, one third of the cattle on feed will be heifers, and then we'll know we're actually retaining heifers to put back in the breeding herd. I mean, what market signal drives heifer retention? Prices. Because most people work off of a cash flow type system, and when prices are high, they don't have to sell as many animals to get the same cash flow as they're used to pay the bills. So then they keep back more heifers. Well, then when prices go low, they sell more heifers because they need more cash flow. That's just been the typical thing. Now, what has happened over the past couple of 3 years, and this is for sure certain in my state of Tennessee, and it's if you looked at the drought monitor very often, I realize we have all the Texas Commissioner of Agriculture. He thinks we need to have a tax credit for heifers now. I appreciate his thought process here, but I think it's ridiculous. That's not how, you know, the market will correct itself. The market will fix itself. The problem the past three falls, here's what's happened the past three falls in much of cattle producing country, is drought in late summer and early fall. Well, see, when people are weaning these calves and they're in drought, they're not thinking, oh, I need to keep a few extra to grow the beef cattle herd because prices are so high. They're thinking, I don't have anything to feed them. I'm going to get rid of them. And unfortunately, we've had several recent droughts within the past decade, 15, 20 years. People are like, I really don't need to take this chance. So the market, those higher prices are going to eventually drive expansion if the environmental conditions provide the opportunity to do so. It's just so far, the environmental conditions haven't provided that opportunity. And so you give them tax credits, give them, I don't care, give them whatever you want, but they're not going to keep them until they actually have the resources to do so.
I agree 100% on that. Now, a question that I hear come up a lot is when it comes to heifer slaughter and those numbers that are shared by USDA, we see the weekly slaughter sheets, all of those things. But do we ever get a dilution effect with some of our increase in acceptance of the beef on dairy animals, where we have both steers and heifers coming in a lot of circumstances at the same rate?
I guess there could be some dilution scenarios, but in reality, a lot of those dairies are going to be using sex semen in most situations. So they're going to be using, if they want females, they're going to be using sex semen for their best cows, to produce really high quality heifers to go back into the dairy herd. And then alternatively, they're going to be using sex semen to produce male calves just because a male calf is more valuable than a female calf. And so if we're going to go, they have their hands on those animals every day. So it's not it's not like a cow-calf guy that just needs to get her bred, right? It's like, well, I don't care if it's, we're going to AI them, we're just going to AI them. Because, I mean, that's what most of them are doing. They're not, they don't own bulls. Most of these dairies aren't, I mean, they're just AIing these cows. And rightfully so, because that's the cheapest way for them to do it in reality, and keeps another mouth out and out of the, you know, another bull out of the way, or however many they have. So I don't know that there's that much of a dilution effect. I'm not saying there couldn't be, but I just, from what my experience has been, most of these people, you know, we're just producing male cross calves, dairy beef crosses. And hey, when they're worth $1,000 or more on day three, pretty good income for a dairyman.
Which is still wild to think about, that the days of a free bucket calf for 4-H kids are gone.
Yep. When you couldn't get them away. Yeah.
No, you can, yeah. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, where you couldn't give away some of those calves. And now that same animal as a crossbred is worth over $1,000, you know, almost as a wet calf, which is amazing. But that's the market we're living in. Now, for, you know, to go back to, you know, your point on herd expansion, do you really foresee this being more regional, feed dependent? True dollars and cents, it's going to be driven by those key fundamentals going forward.
Yeah, I really do. I really do think that's it. You know, I hear all the time, oh, we've got this aging beef producer and aging farmer, and this is why, you know, and we've got some encroachment by development and houses and industry. And that's not incorrect based off the data. I'm not saying it's incorrect, but what if you get out here in the country and you ride around, you realize there's a lot of underutilized land out there. We could be producing a whole lot more food than what we are right now in this country. And it's because we're not efficient at doing it, or we haven't had to be efficient, more efficient than what we are. Every year we're more efficient, right? We've come a long way in efficiencies, but we haven't been forced to be efficient. So it's not that there's not land to graze cattle on. It's not that everybody's so old that they don't want to do it. When you go out here and you see 70 and 80 year old guys that are still getting after it, they're not thinking, oh, well, I'm just going to quit next year. That's not their thought process. This is what they've always known. And so they're just going to keep doing it. And then there's the whole thought process of there's not any young people that want to do this. Well, I disagree, you know, because I feel like I'm still fairly young and that's all I want to do. And I know a lot of young people that, you know, they want to be in agriculture. Now, are they willing to put in the work? The problem there is they want to be where their parents are at, you know, where their parents are at 60. They want to be there at the age of 22. And that's not necessarily feasible. But I really do think that the basic things that influence our market, the economic situation, the environmental situation, I really think that those things will determine when we can expand the beef cattle herd. I'll be honest, as a guy that has cattle, I'm not in a hurry for people to expand the cattle herd. I'd rather just prices be high. You know, I'll just keep on collecting.
Well, let's shift gears. We talked about the supply side. What about the packer end? What about packer demand, slaughter capacity? Is that playing a role with cattle prices today? I know it did with the, if we go back in time to the plant fire at Holcomb in Kansas, that really played with prices. But with what we have going on today, we had a plant closure in Lexington, Nebraska, you know, packer demand to be able to purchase these animals, slaughter capacity, rail capacity. I guess, is that playing a role into some of the cattle pricing today?
I would say it's not really doing much to influence prices, because cattle feeders can still just name their price almost, and the packer just keeps paying more. I mean, when you look at the fact that cattle or packers are paying more for cattle on a dress basis than what box beef prices are, there it's guaranteed loss. It's a guaranteed loss. All they have else otherwise is the drop credit, you know, the hide and the offal items. And so when they are literally paying more for that dress 950-pound carcass than what they're getting for the meat, value of the meat in that carcass, And that hadn't even been cut up yet. You know, we hadn't got any labor processing cost at all. So when you think of it from that standpoint, you're like, well, and we're going to see more consolidation in the packing industry. We will see more now, if that's plant closures, if that's somebody buying somebody else out, that I think that's one of the reasons why Walmart was strategic in how they've partnered with a packing facility. The Four Sixes Ranch has their, they have a deal, so we're going to see more and more of this, and it will look more like vertical integration, even though it's not completely vertical integration because they're still solely owned entities. They're just contract agreements of some sort. Now, there could be some vertical integration, just depending on how things are written. But we're going to see more plant closures, and they're going to be the plants they're going to close are going to be the ones that are less efficient, the ones that have older tools that need retooling. That's what we'll see.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. We do have aging infrastructure in the packing industry. I mean, across the entire United States. I mean, yes, we have a few new plants that have come onto operation or coming onto operation. But if we look at some of our older plants, my goodness, I mean, they've been retrofitted over the years, but it's been a while. So for the overall health of the entire industry, it may not be a bad thing to slow down some of those facilities to rebuild some of the infrastructure, for the next 30 years.
What will happen to begin with is just a shuttering of the plant, right? And so we don't know how any of that will progress. And who knows if we even need that capacity back? That'll be the question. You know, it used to be that there were discounts for small carcasses and large carcasses. And right now there's no discount for a large carcass. We just keep growing them bigger and bigger because the packer needs, it's the cattle feeder, the packer, even the stocker producer that wants to operate at the same number of cattle can't do that because the same number of cattle aren't out there. And so, you take a cattle feeder who has enough pen space for a one-time pen space of 100,000 head, and right now they might have 60,000. Now, are they ever really at full capacity? No, but they probably would be most efficient running at 80 to 85% capacity. Well, here they are at 60% capacity. Well, that's the same way with the packer. We don't need any Saturday harvest. You know, no reason to harvest on Saturday because we don't have enough cattle for it to matter. Why do we need three shifts? You know, we'll just cut it back to two shifts. And so, there's going to be jobs that disappear, and there will be those few plants that completely close and that we never see open again. They'll just be an empty building because what other use do they have? I mean, Tyson has been known to shut a plant and take everything out of it so that it can't be reopened as a processing facility or packer. And that's their prerogative. Is that added cost to take? Sure, it's added cost, but they don't want the competition. That's understandable. So we're going to continue to see those types of things, and you can't ever outguess what decisions some people will make.
Now, you alluded to it, but I'm going to try to get you to say it. You know, if we look at long-term cattle cycles, we've continuously shrunk our herd over time as we've gotten more efficient. As we rebuild for this next cattle cycle, will we go back to our last numbers, or are we going to continue that trend of having lower cow numbers, bigger animals, more efficient animals going into the future?
The simple answer is we won't have as many animals. I mean, if you look at the trend, and that doesn't mean a trend line can't change direction, right? That's not what I'm saying, because it can change direction. But if we look at what the trend has been over the past several decades, sure, if we increase the cattle herd, it's not going to be back to the high that we had in 2017, 18, or whatever it was. It's just not going to happen. No reason for it to happen. And if you're in the industry, why would you want it to happen? I mean, you don't want to overproduce and then result in a loss in your business.
No, agreed on that. I mean, there's a lot of those directions, and from the feedlot perspective, I mean, it's right there. I mean, that understanding is know that we're going to go to a little bit, fewer animals, but more efficient, maybe produce it while still producing the same amount of beef. right? So I want to stick with the crystal ball since you got the crystal ball on your head. let's fast forward. Let's look the next 5 years. What economic trends are going to impact beef cattle production and prices the most over the next 5 years? Is it going to be wild outside stuff at the border with New World screwworm? Is it just going to be supply and demand? Is it going to be trade and tariffs and things like that? I guess what's going to be the most impactful to beef prices going forward?
Unfortunately, I think it's going to end up being policy measures that play into all of those things that you mentioned. There are a lot of people that I do not understand. Let's go back to New World screwworm for just a brief second. I do not understand why people would think that the introduction of New World screwworm into the United States would be a negative to beef prices. That doesn't make sense. It seems like to me that would reduce beef production more, which then would increase prices because we have less of it. Unless they're saying the consumer is going to be so scared of screwworm, which my grandfather was a veterinarian, and there were screwworms when he was a veterinarian, you know, back in the day. So it's not like it's new to this country. Now, it's new to our veterinarians today in that most of them haven't been exposed to them, but they have been around. But we do look at international trade things such as reopening the border to Mexican cattle. In reality, that has helped support cattle prices domestically as well. The people that has hurt the most would be those people in the Southern Plains, in Texas, in New Mexico, that need those cattle. Because, you know, there's a lot of backgrounders. There's a lot of feedlots. There's packers in those areas. And the inability to source those cattle out of Mexico has put them in a terrible bind. It really has. And the thing of it is, those are genetics that are meant for the South. You don't just take a calf out of Iowa or North Dakota and send him to you know, the Mexican border. You don't even really do that with Tennessee cattle. In reality, there's a few, you know, we've got a few of those ear cattle, but not that many. And then, you know, as I said, you know, here we've got President Trump who has decided that we're going to import 100,000 metric tons of beef from Argentina. You know, that's not even a pound of beef more person. It's like half a pound of beef a person a year. Now, the thing of it is, you take that out 5 years and we have a different administration in office. And if we have different leadership in this country, I mean, you can see the stark contrast between a Biden administration and a Trump administration. And I don't mean to get political because that's not the point of this. But you can see those stark contrasts and how they're different from the agricultural community. You know, 5 years, that's a hard thing to project. But all of these things, well, I mean, it's just like here, we would think that beef cow, you know, people would start retaining heifers. Well, I can't predict what the weather's going to be this summer or this fall. I can't, yeah, I mean, our weather people can't even predict tomorrow very well. But yet they still pay them. So there you have it.
They did predict the ice storm pretty well that went through the South.
Oh, yeah, they did. They knew it was going to hit. They just didn't know. They kept changing every day where it was going to hit and how much you was going to get. And, you know, for most part, they actually know what the temperature is going to be. But, you know, it's still like a – you're a veterinarian. Well, they call it a veterinary practice, right?
Yeah, it's not always fact. We just kind of we figure it out as we go.
Yeah, you're practicing.
Yeah,
and I think that's what you know. Meteorology is the same way, and I'm not. I don't mean that negative towards those people. I don't mean it. I mean I'm thankful we have them. But the cattle industry, you know, it's a bunch of individuals making individual decisions. We can't predict what outside factors will impact those decisions.
No, that's fair. There's a lot more that we're going to figure out as we all wade through this together. And I agree. I completely agree. There's a lot of question marks there, but we'll figure it out together.
It's time for our famous three.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A diet forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
Well, Dr. Griffith, we've had great conversation. I know we could keep going and keep talking about this stuff for, you know, ad nauseum for the next day or two, but we don't have that kind of time. But so I'm probably going to shut us off here. But I can't let you go without doing all of our on the Beef Podcast show. We always have all of our guests that we ask them three specific questions to help everybody listening grow, develop as an educator, as a learner, as a lifelong learning. I guess, where do you go to find, I guess question one would be, where do you go to find information? What is your go-to that if you would recommend a resource, cattle industry, cattle-related resource, what's your go-to?
That's a really tough question because I just read a lot. You know, I've got things that come directly to my email, you know, whether it be a Beef Daily or a Drover's Daily or a Dairy Herd Daily, Pork Daily, you know, you think about all these things and you know, you get the NCBA stuff and you get your local cattlemen's. And so I go to other extension people. I guess the thing that I would encourage people, because I mean, there's information galore, right? Google, you can Google anything and find just about, now I'm not saying the information you're getting is correct, but I guess when I'm really in need of information, the one thing that I am not afraid to do is just get a hold of the right person and call them and just ask the question. And so I don't like to read. You know, people, well, do you read? Have you read this? No, I don't read that because I don't have to. I read about cattle stuff. That's what I do. I mean, that's my job. And the last thing I want to do is read about something that's fake, you know, fiction. And so. You know, oddly enough, I like veterinary stuff. It's pretty interesting because I'm constantly trying to figure out. Well, I successfully amputated a leg about a year ago. You know, on a calf. I was successful. I was trying to save the leg. Well, it successfully lived, and the leg is gone now. So you know, I was like, I didn't get my job done, but I was still successful because the calf's still alive. So I guess, you know, I don't know that I have any particular sources that I just lean on. I mean, I do lean on extension stuff tremendously because most of the time it's research based and we do want that research information. But I also talk to my neighbors. You know, I'm like, well, what's working for you and what's not working for you? Because as a guy that has cow-calf and a stocker operation, some of those antibiotics aren't working at certain times.
Well, that's why we call it the practice of veterinary medicine. So contacting your local veterinarian is important, too.
I talked to three of them. I have three that I work with.
I love it. So question number two, you know, I know you're a cattle guy through and through, but outside of agriculture, outside the cattle business, when you're not working, what are you diving into? What are you, you know, I know you kind of alluded to that. You're reading about cattle stuff, but what else are you diving into kind of outside of work?
There's only one other thing that I do other than work, and that's read my Bible. I mean, that is, faith is the only other thing. I mean, I have a wife and children, but to me that kind of goes hand in hand with my faith. So I work way too much because I like to work. If I'm not working the day job, I'm farming. A closer relationship with my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, there's nothing more important than that.
No, and that's one way to keep us grounded is when we follow true, it keeps us on the right path. So, no, I'm in complete agreement with that, too. So, third and final question I'm gonna needle you with is you've been working in academia for quite some time now, as I have. You've worked with a lot of individuals. You've seen a lot of people at different institutions. I guess what makes a good leader and a mentor in our type of work?
So I guess to answer that question, I'll answer it based off of the characteristics of people that have mentored me, and the people that have directed me in the right direction. Most important qualities is being able to listen, not a hearer, a listener. Everybody won't agree with this to go along with that, but experience. Somebody that has experience makes. I know this is, it's kind of taboo to say that in a culture today where everybody wants everything right now, but it's hard to lead when you haven't done something or you hadn't been around something. And I've seen that with politicians, local, state, federal, you know, the national level, you know, trying to be, so just having the ability to listen, having experience, a willingness to try to understand other people's points of view, whether you agree with them or not, trying to understand their points of view, because the whole key of leadership, the whole key is relationship. Nobody's going to follow somebody that they don't feel comfortable with, that they don't feel has their interest in mind. So I would say those are probably the three things that I think are most important. I mean, there's a plethora of other characteristics, but I don't think those are characteristics that people are always at the forefront of their mind.
Well, I'm glad you brought those up. I think those are all, I mean, when we start, it's difficult to quantify all the different characteristics that make those people that you look up to, that I look up to, that have helped us along our way. But I hope people listening in take that to heart and think about those things as they're living their daily lives, as they're interacting with people, building those relationships. I think that's really important. So with that, you've been a wonderful guest on the Beat Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. Again, this is Dr. Andrew Griffith, University of Tennessee. Look him up. He's a wealth of knowledge and helps a lot of producers in that region. And with that, thank you, and we'll see you again.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.